and it feels like a deep red cherry night. I wanna be alive with you. All bitterness aside, can't wait till it's almost ripe. I wanna be alive with you.
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, January 23rd, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering the latest show in the Kingston Symphony's pop series, taking you to a galaxy far, far away, a small but meaningful change for the Museum of Healthcare, what's happening in Springer Market Square's skating rink this weekend, updates from City Council's latest meeting, and more. Without further delay, let's dive in. Boards will soon be going up around the outdoor rink in Springer Market Square, a familiar sight each year as the city prepares for its annual historic hockey game, reenacting Canada's first ever game played in 1886 on the frozen Kingston Harbour. This year, however, the boards won't come down right away. Instead, they'll stay up for 4 full days of programming. Boards Up, Rink Sports in the Square runs from Thursday, January 22nd to Sunday, January 25th, inviting Kingstonians to watch and take part in a variety of rink sports. The lineup includes more hockey than ever before, with curling and ringette joining the schedule as well. I spoke with Sandy Griffiths, events manager with the Downtown Kingston BIA, about what's planned over the next 4 days in Springer Market Square. Well, to start us off, I was wondering if you could tell us what Boards Up is all about and where this idea kind of came from.
Yeah, absolutely. So every year, the ice rink in Springer Market Square, the city installs boards around the rink for a short period of time, and they do it for the annual historic hockey game. And so because, you know, it's a bit of work to get the boards up, the city came to us and to the BIA and said, hey, the boards are up anyway. Do you want to program the ice? Maybe program some games, some demonstrations so folks can come down and watch. And we said, absolutely. And so we decided to do sort of a rink sports in the square event that would, I mean, typically of sports that are played that require boards and netting. And so we're doing a 4-day demonstration of different rink sports, and that'll start this Thursday.
Awesome. And we'll get into all these new sports that you've added, but I did want to chat about the historic hockey game because I actually didn't know this piece of Kingston history, that Canada's first hockey game took place here. I was wondering if you could dive into that and the reenactment.
Yeah, so the first ever game was played on Kingston Harbor. So the harbor was frozen, and that game was played between RMC Cadets and Queens. I believe the year was 1886. And so the historic hockey reenactment game has been around for a long time, and we're doing it again this year. They take it very seriously, like the uniforms that they wear. There's a square puck that they play with. Apparently the first puck used to be square. And there are 3 teams that participate. So it's RMC, it's Queens, and it's the Royal Artillery Brigade out of Petawawa. And so they play for a couple of hours, and it's just really fun to see them in the old school uniforms playing with a square puck. They try to keep, even some of the rules are a little bit different. So it's a fun thing for hockey fans and for anyone really to enjoy.
Awesome. Yeah. And what are these new sports that you've added in this year?
Yeah, so Thursday night there'll be a curling demonstration. So from 6 to 8, you can come down to Springer Market Square. They're going to pebble the ice, and we actually have lighting, like overhead lighting, that will project curling rings onto the ice. So the Greater Kingston Curling Club will be there. They'll do short demonstrations, and then they'll actually give people an opportunity to try and throw a curling rock, which I've never done, which I'm excited to do. So that will be fun. That's from 6 to 8. Friday night will be ringette. So there'll be a ringette team. Two ringette teams will be squaring off starting at 6. Of course, Saturday is the historic hockey game. And then at 3:30 on Saturday, members of the Kingston Frontenacs will be in the square, and so you can skate with some of your favorite local hockey heroes. Barrick the Bear will be there as well, so that's always a fun time. And then Sunday is minor hockey day. So Sunday we've got teams from all of the local minor hockey clubs that will be participating in sort of a round robin, and those are the little guys. We also have some all girls teams, which is exciting. So just, 4 days of outdoor sport activity in the square.
Awesome. And are you hoping that this will continue and be a tradition alongside the annual reenactment game?
Yeah, I think it's a fun way to introduce the community to the different sports that sort of happen in the city. It's a great accessible way to try things like curling. It's also a great opportunity for parents and grandparents and friends to see their little ones play on the ice in Springer Market Square. That's always fun for parents. So yeah, I mean, definitely historic hockey will continue. And so I think if we can get the Kingston community rallying behind this and showing support and coming down and interacting and viewing and cheering, then it's definitely something that we'll continue to bring back.
Once again, that was Sandy Griffiths with Downtown Kingston on Boards Up Ring Sports in the Square, running until Sunday, January 25th. For full details and updates, visit downtownkingston.ca. At their last meeting, council passed an advocacy-based motion about measles vaccination awareness. This motion comes after the Pan American Health Organization notified the Public Health Agency of Canada that Canada has lost its measles elimination status due to sustained transmission over more than 1 year. According to Ontario Public Health, between 2013 and 2023, Ontario reported a total of 101 measles cases. In 2025 alone, there were 2,395 reported cases in the province. Local data from Southeast Public Health indicates higher vaccination rates in the KFLNA region, with an overall regional measles immunization coverage of 90.7% among the school-age population. However, the motion was brought forward with the concern of overall declining vaccination rates, vaccine misinformation, and the disruption of routine immunizations during the COVID-19 pandemic. Specifically, the motion asks that Council affirm the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine, encourage residents to verify their vaccination status with their healthcare provider or Southeast Public Health, and urge the public to rely on credible health information and avoid sources that promote vaccine misinformation. Councillor Jeff McLaren brought the motion before Council, seconded by Councillor Connie Glenn.
It came to my attention through Public Health that Canada lost our measles elimination late last year. Around November is when I heard about it. And then we talked about why this was happening. A lot of it might be some of the misinformation that's coming from south of the border and all of that. But it is a little bit embarrassing that we, a first world country with a first class healthcare system, lost this designation. It's been the first time we've done it in almost 30 years. 20 to 30 years was the last time that we had lost this. And this is dangerous. It is critically important for the health of our country and our community to make sure you've been vaccinated. It is a lifelong immunity, but if you haven't been vaccinated, you will be transmitting this. And if you thought COVID was bad and we don't have herd immunity, it's going to be worse for those who get it. The least, the smallest, the most mild symptoms are life-threatening.
One of the reasons for talking about this, although we have a high vaccination rate here in KFNLA, is the concept of herd immunity means that we're also protecting those who cannot be vaccinated. There are individuals that are allergic to vaccinations. Small children who have yet to receive one are at high risk. So putting this out there is really to remind us as a community that we have a duty of care to one another. And I think it was quite shocking to a number of individuals in the healthcare community to see us lose that elimination status. Again, this is one of the most communicable diseases on the planet. We can't continue to be complacent. We need to make sure that we continue to re-message, to make sure that everyone is understanding the importance of continuing to keep up to date with vaccinations, measles and others. But right now, I'd like to see Canada regain its elimination status in short order. And we can do that if we continue to message out on as many channels as possible.
The motion was carried with a vote of 12 to 1. With the sole opposing vote coming from Councillor Gary Osterhoff. Messaging about the measles vaccine will be posted through the city's communication channels in coordination with Southeast Public Health's public information efforts. The Museum of Healthcare is entering a new chapter, announcing it will now be known as the Canadian Museum of Healthcare, a name change that reflects the museum's growth and an expanding vision for its future. Located in the Ann Bailey Building on the Kingston General Hospital site, the museum explores the history of healthcare from the 18th century to the modern era. While rooted in Kingston, its exhibits already tell stories from across the country, highlighting key developments in national medical history. Anna Collette, Programming and Communications Coordinator with the Canadian Museum of Healthcare, spoke to the decision to change the name.
This has been a long time coming because our collection is actually quite national. We have over 35,000 artifacts in our collection, and it's the largest collection of medical artifacts in Canada. So we thought it was a great time to, with the new year, to start aligning ourselves with our collection and our actual outreach.
Collette says visitors shouldn't expect a dramatic shift in the museum's direction. The gallery already features artifacts and stories from across Canada, tracing the progress of healthcare nationally. Also making the new name a more accurate reflection of what the museum already offers. Collette shared some of the museum's current offerings.
So with our national collection, we can certainly reach within our own collection as well. One example I can think of is a pair of dentures that was made by a man in British Columbia, and he didn't want to pay for his dentures, so he actually went and shot a deer and filed down the teeth to make a pair of deer teeth dentures. That's another interesting artifact we have that's from British Columbia. One exhibit we have focuses on vaccination and immunization, so it takes quite a large scope because it looks at cases of different diseases like polio, diphtheria, and smallpox, and how that has changed since vaccination programs have been introduced. So it takes quite a large scope, and we have an artifact called the Iron Lung, which was built in Toronto, and it's quite the star artifact at the museum. It was used for children who had polio who couldn't breathe on their own. It's from the 1930s before a vaccination was introduced, so it really shows a time before vaccines.
Looking ahead, the Canadian Museum of Healthcare will continue the work it has always done, all while embracing new opportunities to tell an even broader range of stories from Canada's healthcare past.
So we're hoping it brings a bit more attention to healthcare history and also our role in Kingston and reaching even further to national scope. So starting in Kingston, we've always been deeply rooted in Kingston, but hoping to branch out a little bit. The Canadian Museum of Healthcare is open Wednesday to Friday, 10 to 4 during the winter. And starting in June, we're open every day from 10 to 4. And students with their IDs, admission is $5.
On Saturday, January 24th, the Kingston Symphony is inviting audiences to experience one of film's most iconic musical universes with a concert that dives deep into the legendary scores of Star Wars, from the 9 canon films to The Mandalorian, Rogue One, and beyond. From the instantly recognizable themes by John Williams to the newer additions, the music of Star Wars promises a night of cinematic sound at the Kingston Grand Theatre. I spoke with music director Evan Mitchell about this upcoming show in the Symphony's Pop series and why the music of Star Wars continues to resonate generations later. You've played pieces from Star Wars before, but I don't think ever like this. What made you want to do a full deep dive into the Star Wars universe?
Well, taking a look at things in the aggregate. I've always believed that large-scale cinematic universes, if you'll pardon that term, I know it gets overused quite a bit, they become fairly common. And musically speaking, I would say the one that has the most rich, most impactful, dare I say, the best music is the Star Wars universe. And that's something we've wanted to celebrate for some time. And as a result, given that desire and given the enormous volume of music that exists for the Star Wars universe, it felt like a pretty natural decision.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of the most recognizable music worlds in pop culture. What do you think it is about these scores that makes them work so powerfully?
I think an awful lot of credit needs to be given to John Williams. In the original set of Star Wars films, he created a sound world, but even more specifically, a set of musical themes that would define the musical nature of Star Wars at large. And that's something that other composers have had to grapple with, but they've brilliantly added their own stamp onto things as Star Wars has evolved over the decades. But because John Williams started it all and wrote so many incredible themes, I think that that has sort of become part of the DNA of Star Wars, musically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that has been a significant reason why the music is so memorable and so closely associated to Star Wars at large.
Mm-hmm. And kind of diving a bit deeper into what you were saying there, everything's very grounded in that original series score. But I was wondering if you could also speak to how it's kind of changed and evolved. I'm sure looking at all these pieces together over the long span of the series has been interesting for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, particularly take a look at the way things spaced out over the course of since the original trilogy, which spanned from roughly 1977 to 1983, and then going to the prequel trilogy, which actually had quite a lot of amazing music. That's, I want to say, 1999. To 2000, early 2000s. And then, of course, more than a decade after that, I want to say Force Awakens was about 2016, if memory serves. So there's a huge amount of time for the canon, the nine canon films, spanning from, 1977, spanning essentially 45 years. And so that's all musical extensions of the same story, which involved using the same musical themes for the characters who remain and evolve and grow over the course of those nine films, but also a lot of new and original themes written for the most recent three films. Yeah, in the J.J. Abrams trilogy, Force Awakens, and onward. So it's really interesting. But then beyond that, we have the rest of the cinematic universe. The TV series, the films that are sort of taking place in the nooks and crannies of the Star Wars universe that aren't part of that Skywalker story, the Han Solo film, of course, Rogue One being the very first film, I think, for based on that was in the Star Wars universe that was not including music by John Williams. That's a Michael Giacchino score. We're going to be playing some music from that. The Mandalorian thing was a turning point for what Star Wars could be as part of that television series. We're including music from that as well. And so it's really a quite a tapestry that we're presenting for the Star Wars musical universe at large.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is different about hearing this music with the full live orchestra compared to experiencing it on the screen or through soundtracks?
Well, first and foremost, by putting the focus on the music and by having it be part of a live concert, music for film and television, by definition, is there as sort of an accompanying aspect. It's there to elevate the film. It's there to enrich an emotional experience or a visceral experience. Or its absence is often there to sort of pinpoint something emotionally in the film. But the point being is that it's, I don't want to say that it's secondary to the film, but it's in service to the film. And when we have the concert proper, when you're just hearing this music and then that becomes the focus, first off, it means you have a little bit more freedom in being able to interpret how fast or slow something should go. You're not worrying about having in sync to a picture and to the vision of the director from a cinematography perspective, but it just becomes pure music. And the best film television music stands on its own merits. And of course, all the music that we're going to be performing does that and then some. And so it will draw people into the rich harmonic and sonic soundscapes that the various composers were conjuring up to bring us ever deeper into this world.
And from the podium, I was wondering, what's the biggest difference between conducting film music like this and a traditional classical program?
I wouldn't say there's that much of a difference, particularly if you take a look at John Williams' writes in the Grand Symphonic Tradition. It's really not all that different from conducting a piece from the Romantic era. I think good music is good music. This, I have the extra consideration of thinking about what does this particular passage represent in the film, and do I want to sort of bring that out? Do I want to highlight a character or highlight a sound world or these sorts of things as it relates to the experience of watching it? Because I think a lot of people, what's going to happen is that they'll hear, for example, the opening fanfare, the iconic fanfare. And for them, that will represent the title crawl or the opening of each film, just like the point of introduction to this grand space opera, the opening of it all, you know. So I think about those sorts of things, but it's really, I don't have to stray too far from my quote-unquote classical training, shall we say, because it's music is very much written in that vein. It just has a specialized purpose originally in mind. And so as long as I'm thinking about that also, then it's very similar.
And what can audiences expect walking into this concert next weekend?
It's a celebration of the music that they know and love. It's a celebration of a great cross-section of the entire Star Wars universe. As I mentioned, we include all nine of the music from all three of the trilogies. We have music from The Mandalorian. We have music from Rogue One. So it's, in a sense, it's an attempt to showcase some of the very best and most memorable and beloved music from this franchise performed live. And there's something about a live performance, of course, as we all know, it's an experience unto itself. So just going to have a great time. And we're going to be having a great time as well, being immersed in such wonderful music. It's a concert we're all looking forward to.
And you don't have to answer specifically if you feel like it'd be too much of a spoiler, but I was wondering if you personally had any tracks that you're specifically really looking forward to.
Look, I love all this music, and I was the one who put this program together. So I will often curate things that I think people want to hear this and people should hear this. That's my primary concern rather than I want to perform this. But there's so much wonderful music from just this. It's an incredible treasure trove of just hours upon hours upon hours of music. And we're really lucky that it's been published in its original format. That's something to bear in mind, that we're not doing reductions or arrangements of this music. This is all from the signature series of Star Wars music. So these are the original cues from the films. And the way that you hear them will be the way that you remember them from the films. So I will say that I am particularly impressed with how John Williams was able to continue his sort of excellence with the most recent trilogy of films. We will be performing some music from The Force Awakens. And I think that some of the best music in the Star Wars universe was composed for The Force Awakens. And so it's going to be a particular joy for me to be able to showcase that.
That was Evan Mitchell, music director with the Kingston Symphony. The music of Star Wars takes place Saturday, January 24th, 2026 at the Kingston Grand Theater as part of the Symphony's Pops series. Tickets are available at kingstonsymphony.ca or through the Grand Theater box office. Reporting from a galaxy far, far away for CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today with CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, January 23rd, daytime high of -9. But we will see less wind chill. So in the sun at the peak of the day, it'll actually feel a little closer to -4, even if the temperature is technically forecasted to be lower than Thursday. Saturday, January 24th, -8 is your high. Snowy, cold, feeling like -17. Sunday, January 25th, -14, with a wind chill feeling closer to -20. A little bit of sun, mostly clouds in the forecast. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, January 26th, high of -11, feeling like -20, with a 60% chance of snow in the forecast as well. This week's City of Kingston Traffic Report has very little to report, but I do want to remind our listeners that the full winter parking restrictions went into effect on January 1st. During January and February, overnight on-street parking is not permitted, no matter the weather conditions. That will change in March, where overnight on-street parking will be banned only if the weather and conditions require it, so think particularly snowy or icy evenings. When restrictions are in place, parking on city streets is prohibited from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. On the streets surrounding Kingston General Hospital, the ban runs from 12 a.m. to 7 a.m. Vehicles left on the street during bans are subject to ticketing and towing. To learn more about parking restrictions, how they work, and to stay informed, you can visit the City of Kingston website.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. The Food Policy Council for KFLNA is continuing its work towards a comprehensive regional food strategy, launching a series of 5 targeted focus groups over the coming weeks. In collaboration with Queen's University and other community partners, the council is embarking on consultations designed to better understand what communities across Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington need in order to build a sustainable and equitable local food system. These consultations will take a deeper dive into 5 key areas: rural food production, urban food production, food security, food retail and distribution, and food education and literacy. The first consultation, focused on rural food production, including farmers and market gardeners, took place on Monday. Members of the Food Policy Council, co-chair Ellen Mortfield, and Queen's University School of Environmental Studies assistant professor Kristen Lowitt sat down to discuss the launch of the consultation process and what it aims to achieve. Mortfield explained what's led the council to this stage in its work.
It's been quite a few years building to this point. Last year, working with Kristen and Queen's University, the Food Policy Council did secure a bit of funding to launch us on this process of starting a food strategy for Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington. So we've been slowly building. We had some more casual potluck events over the summer just to get the conversation started. And now we're conducting these kind of targeted focus groups with specific sectors within the food system. So last night was our first one with the rural food production folks. We had a good turnout. I think there's about 20, wasn't there, Kristen?
Yeah, I think probably, 14, 15 producers?
Yeah. And really interesting conversations, lots of ideas. We started to work towards prioritizing some of those ideas, some action items that we'll be able to pursue. And all of these sort of ideas and goals and objectives and action plans will be set out in the finished food strategy. But at this stage, we're just trying to make note of these ideas, get people connected so we can start pursuing some of these action items, and really make some significant improvements over the next few years in people's access to local food in this area. That's the big goal.
Following several informal meetings over the summer and now one completed consultation, Lowitt says the council is already beginning to identify key themes emerging from the discussions. Among them, the importance of connection across different sectors of the food system and the notion of building food sovereignty in the region.
We did begin, I'll step back for a second, in terms of slightly bigger context. So the Food Policy Council has been around since just over 10 years, since around 2013. And I think its mandate when it started was to, you know, contribute to the community food system in this region. And I think over the summer and the informal potluck series you're referring to, and then, you know, the first session we're having now, I think one of the biggest takeaways, at least for myself personally, is just like the importance of these sorts of forums or events for convening and gathering people in food systems that may not always have a chance to connect or speak to one another. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, people are busy, but there's also, you know, a lot of fragmentations, you know, between, you know, farmers or policymakers or people that are eating food or even teachers that might be teaching or whatever, right? So often there isn't really a way for a lot of these different actors to connect. And so I think that's been really powerful just in terms of sharing ideas. With, you know, with the farmers and food producers last night, for example, you know, and it became clear pretty quickly. There were some shared, you know, issues, concerns sort of in common, right? We had an extended kind of conversation about, you know, distribution and how do we scale up distribution of regional foods, right? And some common challenges experienced with respect to, you know, building a bigger pool of customers and, you know, distributing more widely, right? So I think there's a really big need for these sort of convening. And that's kind of really what the Food Policy Council was meant to do, right? Because too often, you know, food is really sort of, the food system is often really kind of fragmented in terms of policy, you know, like health has a piece over here and then maybe agriculture somewhere else. And often, you know, it's under economic development or whatever, there often isn't a more integrated forum for discussing some of these issues and bringing them together and connecting some of the pieces. And so this summer was really valuable for that because we had folks from across the food system to coming together. The focus group similarly, although we're focusing a little bit deeper now on kind of, you know, specific sort of aspects or questions and kind of groups in the food system. So I think that to me is one of the big takeaways and one of the big values. And, you know, the second would be, I think, related to that is hopefully, you know, this notion of sort of building food sovereignty, right? And in the kind of the larger food system, there's such a lack of control for farmers or fishers or eaters, right? Often in terms of, you know, where's the food coming from, who's growing it, who has control of inputs or seed supplies, you know, farmers being more, you know, price takers and these sorts of things, right? And being squeezed in different ways in value chains and just corporations and governments that are often, you know, complicit with what they want, really not responding to the need of, you know, communities, of localities, of regional, more ecological food production, I want to call it that. So I think, that need to convene and hopefully feel like, I think the local and the regional scales are really powerful in terms of building some of those connections, discussing shared issues and thinking about, you know, what can we do here? What are the assets and values we have here that allow us to build the food system in a more kind of food sovereign, you know, food system that the community, you know, kind of collectively wants.
As mentioned, the council has already gained insight into some of the key challenges and has begun brainstorming potential solutions based on feedback from participants in the first session.
We'll see the commonalities, I think, once we get more of the groups going. But in this first one, I think it was interesting to see some of the ideas that came out. Just people, you know, with this shared experience of in local food production. Some of the things that were talked about is like a food hub or a food cooperative. Is that something that would be helpful to our farmers? Also, some of the issues, like one of our biggest problems here is not enough food being produced locally. Farmers are kind of aging out of the system and they're not being replaced by young people coming into farming. So that's an issue there. And then other things like difficulties with local bylaws and the differences in enforcement and bylaws, even in between the counties, like Lennox and Addington and Frontenac counties, have different ways of dealing with growth in food production and farm businesses. And so those are the sorts of difficulties that the folks that came out to participate last night, those are the kinds of things that they were talking about.
Looking ahead, Mortfield and Lowitz say the next steps will be analyzing the information gathered and beginning to develop concrete action items once the sessions wrap up in early February.
Our hope is that we can kind of prioritize some of these ideas and actions on, you know, the quick wins, the ones that are going to take a few years of work. And we need to identify who needs to be involved to move these forward. And there's lots of work to be done, but setting some goals, you know, having a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, and people at the table that are willing to tackle some of these, that's what we want to achieve out of these sessions.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, you know, the discussions and these focus groups have started to, you know, I've done kind of some of the larger sort of visioning exercises, and now we're really starting to focus on, you know, some of the concrete and tangible actions that communities, organizations, citizens in the food system can take and would like to see. So we've started to do some of that kind of actioning and prioritizing. And I think there's a lot of really, you know, concrete kind of proposals that came up even just in the session last night, right? Like, for example, is there potential to establish a food hub? We spent some time talking about, you know, a cooperative grocery store. There's another really tangible example. We had a representative from CASSI, the Kingston Area Seed Saving Initiative, in attendance, who, you know, really was encouraging members of the community to grow out some of their local and traditional seeds, right? That's a really tangible action, right? That gardeners or school gardeners or farmers can take up, right? So I think we have some really kind of tangible examples, and there's, you know, it's fantastic for our council too, because I think this is the start of a process, right? It's sort of a food strategy, so then we can also identify, you know, some of these, you know, short, medium term, maybe longer term sort of policy actions or initiatives that we want to kind of collectively sort of work on or continue to convene, right, with these other groups in the food system and try to move ahead, right, coming out of this food strategy process.
Several consultations are still on the horizon. The Urban Food Production Consultation, focused on community gardeners, urban agriculture, and food forests, takes place Monday, January 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. The Food Security Consultation, centered on charitable and emergency food access, will follow on Monday, January 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Food retail and distribution, including restaurants and local food outlets and markets, will be the focus on Monday, February 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. The final consultation on food education and literacy involving school boards, public health, and educators takes place Monday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. Community researcher Ayla Fenton is coordinating all 5 sessions. Those interested in participating in a consultation relevant to their work are encouraged to contact her at aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. That's aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. Council has unanimously approved a motion directing staff to examine the feasibility of free or no-fee public transit as part of the city's ongoing transit review. The motion, brought forward by Councillor Ryan Boehm, responds to long-standing questions from residents about whether Kingston could implement a fare free transit system. In a short pitch to council, Boehm outlined why he felt the review was worth including.
It's just providing this extra information for a more holistic review. And most people usually get the emails about, like, why don't we do this? And other cities are doing this. And when you ask those questions, the first thing that comes back is, what's the cost? You know, what are the benefits? What's the total cost? So it's as simple as that. This doesn't commit us to anything other than getting some more information from city staff on a review of transit that was already ongoing anyways. So it just gives us better information going forward.
As Boehm stated, the review will be conducted for informational purposes and will focus on understanding how fare-free systems operate in other cities, as well as the potential implications, costs, and applicability of such a model for Kingston Transit. The feasibility of free transit has not previously been formally studied by the City of Kingston. Findings related to the free or no-fee transit review will be included as part of the broader Kingston Transit Service Review, which is currently underway. Council has unanimously approved a motion calling for a comprehensive review of accessible transportation options across the city. The motion, brought forward by Councillor Brandon Tozzo, directs city staff to examine how existing accessible transit services are working and identify ways to improve and simplify access for residents who rely on them. The city currently subsidizes Kingston Access Bus to provide accessible transportation alongside conventional Kingston Transit services. In 2025, the city also introduced an accessible taxi program through the Kingston and Area Taxi Licensing Commission, designed to enhance service options available to riders. Since then, additional private accessible transportation services have become available. The city is also exploring the implementation of an on-demand transit service in rural areas, which would include an accessible fleet, as early as late 2026. The approved motion calls for staff to complete a board review of all accessible transportation options, including existing subsidies, with the goal of maximizing access for residents and streamlining how people navigate available services. Councillor Tozzo stated the following before council before the vote.
Today, Kingston has multiple accessible transportation options, Kingston Access Bus, Kingston Transit, and the Accessible Taxi Program, which was introduced in 2025. Private accessible providers and soon potentially on-demand transit services in rural areas. Each of these services exists because we as a council care about accessibility. At its core, accessible transportation is the difference between independence and isolation, between being able to participate in community life or being left behind by systems that are simply too hard to navigate. When the ATP program was introduced in 2025, there were hopes that this option would fill another gap. This program has been used, and it's made a real difference for residents who need the more flexible schedule than bus services can provide. I think its uptake demonstrates demand, but it also highlights the need for clear rules, better integration with other services, better eligibility, and a thoughtful approach to how the city coordinates and manages accessible transportation going forward. There are many options for accessibility, but eligibility rules are often unclear. Booking processes are inconsistent. I think that we've all heard from constituents about that. Coverage and affordability vary depending on which phone number you call. And for somebody already living with mobility challenges, cognitive barriers, illness, or age-related changes, that complexity can be overwhelming. And services that exist in silos really don't help anyone. Accessibility should reduce barriers, not create new ones. This motion asks us to step back and look at the whole picture, not to point fingers, not to predetermine outcomes, but to ask whether our current approach currently serves the people it was designated for. Are we making it easier for residents to understand their options? Are subsidies being used in ways to maximize real access? Are new services being integrated in a way that simplifies the experience, or are we unintentionally layering confusion on top of confusion? As we plan for future transit innovations, we have an opportunity to build accessibility from the start rather than retrofitting it later. That opportunity only works if we understand what's working, what isn't, and where people are falling through the cracks. Ultimately, this motion is about the city we want to be, a city where accessible transportation is understandable, coordinated, and dignified, a city where independence is supported, not eroded by confusing procedures, a city where inclusion is reflected not just in our values, but in how people experience daily life, and a city that is a leader in accessibility and inclusion where everyone belongs.
City staff are expected to report back to council with preliminary options for expanded accessible transportation services by the fourth quarter of 2026. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie. In a message directly from the City of Kingston, beginning January 14th, the Market Wing Cultural Space at Kingston City Hall will host A History Exposed, The Enslavement of Black People in Canada, a traveling exhibition created by the Canadian Museum of Immigration at Pier 21, in partnership with Dr. Afua Cooper and the Black Cultural Centre for Nova Scotia. The exhibition will remain on view until May 22, 2026. For many, Canada's connection to slavery is understood primarily through the Underground Railroad. A History Exposed brings to light a lesser-known history, the over two centuries when Black people were enslaved in the territories that would become Canada. Through individual biographies, archival records, and historical context, the exhibition explores who the enslaved people were, who enslaved them, and how this legacy continues to shape our country today. Presented across seven double-sided panels, the exhibition offers a space for visitors to confront Canada's history of enslavement and reflect on its ongoing social and cultural impacts. City Curator Melissa Cruz states, quote, "Hosting this exhibition is an important opportunity for our community to engage with a truth that has long been overlooked in Canadian history. By acknowledging the realities of enslavement in Canada, we take a meaningful step toward understanding the roots of anti-Black racism and creating a more inclusive and informed society. A History Exposed was developed with guest curator Dr. Afua Cooper, one of Canada's foremost scholars of Black history and enslavement, whose research and writing, including her landmark book, The Hanging of Angelique, have shaped national conversations about race, history, and justice. Dr. Cooper emphasizes that recognizing the history of slavery in Canada is essential to understanding the full story of the nation's development and to honoring the lives of those who endured enslavement. Again, the exhibit is on view January 14th to May 22nd, 2026 in the Market Wing Cultural Space at City Hall, 216 Ontario Street. Hours are Tuesday to Friday, 12 p.m. to 4 p.m., and admission is free. Once again, that was a message directly from the City of Kingston on a new exhibit at City Hall. In another message directly from the city, Big Ideas Wanted, applications open for the 2026 Mayor's Innovation Challenge. Big ideas start here. If you know a post-secondary student with a passion for making Kingston better, encourage them to apply for the 2026 Mayor's Innovation Challenge. Offered in partnership with Queen's University, St. Lawrence College, and the Royal Military College, the Mayor's Innovation Challenge invites current and recently graduated students to turn bold ideas into real-world solutions that strengthen our community and shape the future of Kingston. The winning teams will have an opportunity to gain valuable experience through the Summer Company Program and a $10,000 prize sponsored by Bell to advance their idea, or a chance to turn their idea into a business venture with admission to the Queen's Founders and Innovators Initiative, and the opportunity to unlock up to $4,000 in seed funding, along with a chance to compete in their pitch competition with a prize pool of up to $80,000. Mayor Brian Patterson says, quote, "I'm proud to kick off 2026 by opening applications for the 9th edition of the Mayor's Innovation Challenge. Year after year, this initiative highlights the creativity and drive of Kingston's post-secondary students. I'm looking forward to seeing how this new group of innovators brings forward bold ideas, addresses local priorities, and helps shape an even stronger future for our city," end quote. Students are asked to submit a 2 to 3 minute video outlining an innovative project that improves quality of life for Kingston residents or introduces new approaches to delivering municipal services. Teams with proposals that are shortlisted will be invited to present their ideas at the pitch competition on March 20th. The competition will be at City Hall to a panel of leaders with expertise in municipal government entrepreneurship and innovation. Some key dates: interested participants can register for the following workshop. Tuesday, February 10th, 4 to 5:30 p.m. at Mitchell Hall Event Commons, 69 Union Street. You can also join online, registering on Zoom. Friday, March 6th, deadline for proposals at 11:59 p.m. Monday, March 9th, shortlisted teams are invited to the pitch competition. And Friday, March 20th, student pitch competition at City Hall. Don't miss your chance to help shape the future of Kingston. Apply now and turn your bright idea into reality. Learn more about the Mayor's Innovation Challenge on Get Involved Kingston or by emailing mic@cityofkingston.ca. Once again, that was another message directly from the City of Kingston on this year's Mayor's Innovation Challenge. One more message directly from the city this evening: downtown event parking is closer than you think. Planning to head downtown to cheer on the Kingston Frontenacs, to enjoy a concert at Slush Puppy Place or show at the Grand Theater, or to check out Springer Market Square? There are plenty of affordable municipal parking options within a short walk. Recent parking studies show that municipal parking garages and nearby lots regularly have space available during events. Surface lots, on-street parking, and transit add to the mix, giving people more ways to get downtown depending on their plans. The city's new downtown events parking page is now live, giving people a clearer picture of where to park and how close those spots really are to event venues. The page brings event parking details together in one place, including an interactive map showing approximate walking times from nearby parking lots and garages to Slush Puppy Place, Springer Market Square, and the Grand Theater, a link to parking lot and garage details including each site's maximum capacity, affordable flat evening and event parking rates by location, a live camera feed on available spots at the Hanson and Chown parking garages, transit and park ride options — active transportation is a great way to skip the parking spot search — on-street parking, and honk payment information. Know before you go. Visit cityofkingston.ca/eventparking for more information. that is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from Juno-nominated Maple Blues Award-winning local artist Miss Emily's new album, The Medicine, released on November 7th. Produced by Grammy winner Colin Linden, the album blends soul, blues, and roots with an all-star lineup, including players from Bob Dylan and Keb Moe's bands. Pairing her thunderous voice with songs of truth and resilience, Miss Emily channels two decades of raw experience into music that heals and uplifts. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on the Instagram. In the meantime, stream The Medicine by Miss Emily on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Stand Together, Band Together, here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Band together, you know, and I know, and they know, and we know, and everybody.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Pink Velvet, the sophomore single from Kingston-based rap duo D98, consisting of N98 Productions and Jacques Dupel, also featuring a verse from American rapper Black Sam. Following up on their 2025 single ADHD, Pink Velvet is laced with hypnotic production, chill energy, and a luxurious performance by Black Sam. The song discusses the finer things in life, from high-end vacations to making the most of a bad situation, and waxing lyrically on how far you've come because of your craft. It's rich, intoxicating, and is a sneak peek at more to come as the duo builds to their debut album this summer. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Pink Velvet on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
How you holding up, Nate? We good? Yeah, we're chilling. One time. Hey.
She wanna smoke pink velvet. She wanna look at the sky, but them stars on my wrist, I'm way too selfish. Waterfront dining, I just can't help it. Bay by the shoreline, cake by the ocean, soaking the moon with the fork and the shellfish. Yeah, she wanna smoke pink velvet.
I keep my hands clean, smoking my lungs, pink rolled up in the paper. She been waiting on a man to save her. Hop on a plane, Montreal to Jamaica, parasailing in the heart of Barbados. Red stripe, jerk chicken Alfredo, Pier 1, Montego Bay, blue riptide, black salmon filet, high as can be. She wanna smoke pink velvet with me. Head spinning, float away with the leaves. Palm trees blow away in the breeze. Ride the jet ski, Caribbean seas. Green tea gave her something to see. Pink velvet, now she looking at me. Pink velvet, now she down on her knees.
She wanna smoke pink velvet. She wanna look at the sky, them stars on my wrist, I'm way too selfish. Waterfront dining, I just can't help it. Baked by the shoreline, cake by the ocean, soaking the moon with the fork of the shellfish. Yeah, she wanna smoke pink velvet.
Young Ken Dryden, looking for that six of cups. Girls wanna pull my tarot, spinning 45s on indica. Cold 45s in the fridge by a tomahawk steak. I'ma see her when I hit that brush. She monologue praise. Wanna talk dates till I got this place. I'm princess love. That flower capricious. We kick it in hour like Vinny done split it. That seventh day on my shirt. That smoke smell never gonna leave my linen. Rocks my skin cause my wristband grim. Invisibly rich in a bungalow kitchen. Eating fantastic though money is stretching. Converse about hope like a torch. Forbidden, she grinning, yeah.
Smoking on velvet. Palm trees with the shellfish. Pink smoke from the outlet. Plug color, he be jealous.
Crossbody dummy printed. Checkerboard chocolate tinted. The chicken within it is new, but the leather is vintage. Interior Benjamin Sennett. Yeah. Fruit to my label for a minute. Apologize if I've been slurring my sentence. Yeah. Don't gotta throw me no spinach. My patent on all of the styles I've invented. And Issa Laurent, she get what she want. Yeah. Nothing off limits. Just got in a grill. You can tell by my grimace. The stones in it give it a brilliant finish. I got it. All of my references, hope that you caught it. All of my visuals, hunted and shot it. All my residuals sit in my pocket. My shooter on flank when I make a deposit. Yeah.
She wanna smoke pink velvet. Stars on my wrist, I'm way too selfish. Waterfront dining, I just can't help it. Baked by the shoreline, cake by the ocean, soaking the moon with the fork and the shellfish. Yeah. She wanna smoke pink velvet. She wanna smoke pink velvet. She wanna look at the sky, them stars on my wrist, I'm way too selfish. Waterfront dining, I just can't help it. Baked by the shoreline, cake by the ocean, soaking the moon with the fork and the shellfish. Yeah. She wanna smoke pink velvet. She wanna smoke pink velvet.